Today and tomorrow afternoon, we have Dr. Kapoor, who will be speaking on mental health. All of you do know Dr. Kapoor. He is the deputy director of this institute. He was born in Lahore, and he completed his MBBS from Amritsar Medical College and diploma in psychological medicine from the All India Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences, currently known as NIMHANS in Bangalore. In 1965, he went to Edinburgh as a Commonwealth Medical Fellow, where he completed both his PhD in psychiatry and the membership examination of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He's now a Fellow of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He is also a Fellow of the Indian Academy of Sciences and the Fellow of the Indian Academy of Medical Sciences. After returning from Edinburgh, he spent 4 years in rural Karnataka studying the patterns of mental disorder. This work was later published by Hogarth Press, London, under the title Great Universe of Kota. The book is available in the library. Subsequently, he worked as a professor of psychiatry at Kasturba Medical College, Manipal. From 1974 to 1983, he was at the National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences as Professor of Community Psychiatry and the head of the Department of Psychiatry. In 1981-82, he took a one-year ICMR sabbatical to study the effects of yoga on mental states. He'll be talking about this too, I think. From 1983 to 1985, he was the visiting professor at the Center for Theoretical Studies at the Indian Institute of Science. In 1985-1986, he was a Fulbright visiting professor at the University of Harvard at USA. Professor Kapoor joined the National Institute of Advanced Studies in October 1988 and became the deputy director of this institute in February 1990. He has also been a consultant to the World Health Organization on many assignments. He is a winner of the Hari Om Ashram Medical Council of India Award and several other academic awards. He has published 3 books and more than 50 academic papers. Recently, about a few months back, Professor Kapoor was awarded the Eminent Psychiatrist Award for the year 1992-93 by the Indian Psychiatric Society, Karnataka branch. I have formally introduced you to Dr. Kapoor, but there is one thing I'd like to highlight. Like all of you, he is also a teacher. He has been and he still is a teacher. So it's very nice for me to be able to ask my teacher to talk to you, Dr. Kapoor.
Thank you. Susmita said, I am a psychiatrist. And my job is to diagnose and treat mental illness. Over the last 100 years or so, we have learned a lot about mental illness. We understand the patterns, the different varieties of illness. We understand the long-term course of these illnesses. We understand the biochemical, psychological, and social causation of various kinds of mental illnesses. And we have developed a number of therapeutic strategies, some biochemical, some psychological, some social, to treat the phenomenon of mental illness. 50 years ago, the best that a mentally ill person could hope for was custodial care in a mental hospital. But now, in India, besides other places, other countries, most of the patients can be treated at home or in the general hospital settings. Psychiatry has become respectable over the last few years. However, what I want to talk to you today is not about mental illness. I plan to talk about mental health. We, sitting in this room, are not mentally ill, I hope. But you'll agree with me that we are far from being mentally healthy either. From time to time in our lives, or at least once in our lifetime, we must have gone the experience that the vicissitudes of life, the difficulties of coping with difficult people, the various kinds of natural and human-induced problems which we encompass are perhaps too much for us. At least sometime in our life, we have gone that kind of an experience. And in those circumstances, some of us, most of us, perhaps all of us, must have cried out to themselves, I want something more. This is not enough. This is not the way to live. There must be some better way of living. I'm sure we are familiar with this kind of emotion. And it is this more I want to talk about. I want something more. What is that more we are talking about? It is this a better way of life that I want to discuss today. Let me first give you a couple of examples of the kind of existential anguish which I have mentioned, which many of us go through. I'm going to play you a tape of two literary pieces. First is very familiar to all of you, so I won't even mention what it is. And the second, before I start playing it, I shall introduce it briefly. So let's first of all hear the first piece, which describes the kind of existential angst, the anxiety of day-to-day living. Can we play? There was some chance of knowing that after death the life might be happier. We probably would be happier to die, but we don't know that even. And hence, we're always sort of swinging from one mood to the other. This life is not worth living. This, let me go leave this life. And yet, the fear of not knowing what is afterwards. So this kind of agony, maybe not in this literary fashion, we have occasionally experienced. Now let me play to you something else from a different culture. This particular piece is from Yoga Vashistha, and the story is that young Rama goes to Saint Vashistha, and the saint finds him very sad and depressed and says, what's wrong with you? Why are you in this mood? And then Rama replies. And the reply of Rama is what I want to play. Psychiatry is not able to treat this kind of anguish. But our philosophies, our religious texts, have for a long time, not just in one religion, but all religions, they have talked about the way of life which might cut away or cut into these kind of unhappiness, these kind of sorrows. Psychology and psychiatry have only recently started examining this whole question of this other way of life which can tackle the kind of sorrow we have been listening about. There is a psychologist, Abraham Maslow, who some years ago tried to elicit the characteristics of the people who are mentally healthy. What he did was, first of all, he made a hierarchy of the list of needs people have. And he said, basically, people want first food and sex. That's the lowermost need one has. And once that is satisfied, one wants the affection of others. One wants companionship. And once that is satisfied, one wants self-esteem. People should respect me. And once that is satisfied, people want what he calls as self-actualization, the need for self-actualization, need for being yourself. So he made a hierarchy of needs. And then he went about studying about 300 people whom he had selected by asking his friends, people in professions, people employed in various jobs, going and asking them, can you tell me in your neighborhood, in your friendship, is there a person whom you would describe as mentally healthy? He collected some names. Then he asked people, from the literature you have read, can you tell us of some characters you remember whom you would designate as mentally healthy? And he collected some of those names. And then he analyzed the characteristics of these individuals and made out a list of what he would like to call as the characteristics of mentally healthy people. So this is one study which we know of. There have been other studies, but very few. I myself, as Susmita mentioned, examined the effect of yoga on my mental states. I took a year off and I tried to examine what yoga does to my mind. Do I change in any way? Do I go towards the direction which is called mentally healthy? So this was another example of the kind of work which has gone on. There is an anthropologist named Carlos Castaneda who went and studied one particular sorcerer in Mexico. And he was trying to, really he had gone with the idea of studying how the sorcerers work, how the witch men work. But as he worked with this individual, he started learning what this man was trying to teach. He started learning how to be a man of knowledge. He spent about 15 years with this man and came out changed in many ways. And then he described the kind of changes he had experienced himself. There's another colleague of mine in USA, a psychiatrist, who has spent few years under the tutelage, under the direction of a Zen master. And then again started describing what kind of changes in the mind he has experienced himself. But except for these three or four studies, psychologists and psychiatrists have hardly touched this area. I would like to discuss with you some of the findings of these people and then later on pick up also something from the ancient philosophies and see how these the findings of the psychologists, how do they compare with what is taught in our philosophies. This I shall do today. And tomorrow I will take a little longer time to describe my own experiment. That is to say, how I undertook yoga and as a result, what kind of changes I experienced. I hope what I discuss with you will be of some interest to you. Let me start with a very simple kind of definition of mental health. A teacher of mine a few years ago prepared this definition. He said, first of all, mental health means an ability to remain comfortable in a variety of life situations. That's the first part. Ability to remain comfortable in a variety of life situations. Now, I will touch upon this word comfort a little later on, but you understand generally what comfortable means. Comfortable not just at work, comfortable not just in the house, comfortable not with just kind of friends, comfortable in the variety of life situations which keep coming to us from morning to evening, from day to day, from week to week, from year to year. That whatever happens, one maintains the sense of comfort. Like a gyroscope, you know, that toy which used to be, you spin it and it can stay on in any kind of a difficult terrain, difficult position. That kind of a mental pattern. That's the first part of the definition. Then he said the faces and the behavior of those around you are an indication of your mental health. Now that's very interesting. Because a mentally healthy person is not only comfortable himself, but he is able to make others around him comfortable also. And thirdly, he said, it's possible that you may not have yet attained a sense of remaining comfortable yourself. You may not have yet attained an ability to make those around you comfortable, but your desire to become a person of this kind and your effort in this direction is perhaps the greatest sign of your mental health. Yes? I said, first is to remain comfortable yourself in a variety of situations. Second is to make those around you comfortable. And third, even when you have not learned to become a person of this kind, constant striving in that direction, constantly making effort in that direction, that I want to be this kind of a person who is comfortable and is making others comfortable, a desire and an effort in that direction is perhaps the greatest sign of your mental health. And then he said that all these three come as a package deal. That is to say, we know there are people who can be very comfortable at the cost of others. And that's not what mental health means. We also know of people who can make others very comfortable at the cost of being thoroughly miserable themselves. There are people who are sacrificers, that who will constantly sacrifice for others, become uncomfortable themselves, but make others happy. Even this is not mental health. And the third point, he says, a constant effort to go further from where you are is the greatest sign of mental health, because the moment you think you have attained mental health, that moment you have lost it. This is a definition which has stuck to my mind, given by my teacher. It doesn't come in the psychiatry or psychology textbooks. But I think if we keep these things in front of us, we can start moving in that direction a little. So having given this definition, which was put forward by my teacher, let me now recount to you what Maslow said. As I said, Maslow analyzed 300 individuals and then listed out the main characteristics, the main psychological characteristics of these people. And I'll talk to you about that. The first major characteristics of mentally healthy individuals is a more accurate perception of reality. It's interesting that we are talking about mental health, and the first point he makes is that clear and accurate perception is one of the characteristics of those people who are healthy. Now let me explain it a bit. Those of you who have not been familiar with the biology of perception, it might be useful to understand a few little points. See, our eye is like a camera. It's nothing else. The actual vision is in the brain. But if an eye is absorbing an image, and if this eye is stable even for a fraction of a second, the image disappears. I hope I'm making my point, that the image is only brought about because there are repeated images which are coming, and the moment the eye becomes stable, the image disappears. Once the image reaches the brain, then lots of our old memories, lots of other thoughts, our emotions, they enter into the perceptual process itself. So first of all, the way your eye is scanning itself determines what you see. Now, I'm sitting right in front of you, I may perceive this corner because this is the corner I'm looking at. Or I may perceive that corner because that is the corner I'm looking at. But why do I look into this corner? Why do I look into that corner? That is determined by my own needs. And then when the image has come into my head, how I interpret it what it means to me, it also depends upon my own needs. You know very well that if you're hungry and you're walking about on the road, all the signboards which you will see are those which display food. This is a well-known thing. That is, since we are hungry, we look at that which satisfies our hunger. If we have some other need, we look at those kind of signboards. Our desires, our needs, our motivations, they determine what we perceive. So while the sensation which comes through in a particular position may be similar for you and me, what we analyze of it, ultimately what it means to us inside, is very much determined by our own mental state, which includes our needs, our emotions, our thoughts. People who are mentally healthy are able to set aside their own needs and their own emotions when they perceive something. That is to say, the perceptions of these individuals are not determined by their needs, not biased by their own feelings and responses, but much more neutral and hence much more accurate. So he said that is the first definition, that people who are mentally healthy are able to see things more accurately without the interference of their own passions, their own needs and so on. And hence, they're able to generally judge other people more correctly and efficiently also. If our perceptions are independent of our own motivations, we are able to judge other people more accurately also. So he found that these people are good judges of character. Not only of character, when he analyzed them regarding their understanding of politics, understanding of music, understanding of painting, whatever phenomena, he found that these people judge these situations a little more accurately, more correctly. As a result, they were able to predict the future also a little better than the others, because their perceptions were not determined by their emotions. So that is the first indication of a mentally healthy person, that we try to perceive things without letting our biases come in. That's the first point. The second point he made was, mentally healthy people are not threatened or frightened by the unknown. There is always unknown in our life, and as you know and as I know, that frightens us. What is our future likely to be? That's one of the biggest frights we have. What's tomorrow going to be? How am I going to be comfortable? I'm going to retire tomorrow. Will I have enough money? And so on. I'm going to meet somebody for my interview. Is he going to take me or not take me? I'm going to meet a new friend. Is he going to be pleasant, not present? So this kind of unknown is always in our life. And most of us get frightened by this unknown. But he said that mentally healthy people are generally less frightened by the unknown than the others. Einstein once said that the most beautiful thing we experience is the mysterious. And mentally healthy people are able to enjoy the mystery of the known, unknown, enjoy the mystery of what has not yet happened, rather than being rigidified by the fear of it. A corollary of that is that these people are able to live with doubt and postpone decisions when they don't have full information yet. See, very often, out of sheer anxiety, we make decisions. Okay, this is what it is. Because not having a decision is more anxiety provoking than having a wrong decision. But mentally healthy people are able to postpone a decision till their doubts are cleared. They can live with doubt. Next, mentally healthy people are generally free from overriding guilt or shame. Now, this is a very unusual kind of statement. That is to say, they make mistakes also like anybody else. But they don't sit there crying over it. They don't mop over it. They don't lose their night's sleep over it. They have made a mistake. They say, okay, next time I won't make a mistake, and carry on from there. Because guilt, if you will listen to me, is perhaps the most wasteful of emotions. Because guilt doesn't add anything. It doesn't make you change. It only stalls you. Just like they can take their own mistakes and accept them, they're able to accept the mistakes of others also more easily, relatively more easily. It's a very beautiful quote from Maslow, and he says, they're able to accept the sins, weaknesses, and evils of human nature in the same unquestioning spirit with which we accept the characteristics of the nature. We do not complain of water being wet or rock being hard. And we carry on. So they complain less about people. They simply note down the oddities of the world, including their own, comment about it maybe, but do something about it, but not waste their emotional energy. Mentally healthy people have a higher degree of spontaneity. They are simple and natural, and while their inner impulses, their inner thoughts, their inner consciousness may be quite unconventional, they don't go on displaying their unconventionality outside. Outside, they are fairly conservative. They don't have to wear very special kind of clothes to display what they are doing. They don't have to wear a khadi kurta and carry a long thala to show that they are revolutionaries. They are fairly revolutionary people, but they don't need to display it. They have a code of ethics, but code of ethics is more autonomous. That is decided by themselves. And in service of that, they can sometimes break conventions, even laws, and may appear quite ruthless at times. So it is not that mentally healthy people are wishy-washy, cheerful, smiling, kind, goody-goody people. They can be fairly unpleasant at times, but when they are trying to serve their own code of ethics. Mentally healthy people have a center of gravity which falls outside their body. Let me explain it. This is a kind of metaphorical kind of a description, that their lives are centered outside themselves. Normally, all of us look after our needs. All of us look after the needs of our children, our immediate family. But mentally healthy people usually have some kind of a little mission in their life which takes them little away from their immediate selves and immediate families. They're always involved in something which goes beyond themselves. So that's why I said they have a center of gravity outside themselves. They're not concerned with small things. They don't raise a lot of revolutionary dialogues on small issues, smaller issues of life, of which there perhaps can be no immediate solution. Missing an appointment, for example. Somebody misses an appointment with them. They don't go and raise hue and cry too much. Somebody does a personal disservice to them. They'll be careful next time, but it's not necessary to scream and shout at that time. And because of these kind of habits, they are more easy to live with. And I think it's a very important way of judging a mentally healthy person, that you generally find yourself easy and happy in their company. It's very interesting. It is said that emotions are more contagious than smallpox. if you are in a bad mood, you spread that bad mood around quite easily, faster than you will spread the germs of an illness. And so the opposite. If you are fairly comfortable within yourself, you will induce a sense of comfort in the colleagues you are sitting with. Next point. Mentally healthy people have an ability to live alone. Now, it's a very important point. We have at times tried to live alone or have had to live alone in our room. Supposing I go for a meeting somewhere in a town which I'm not familiar with, I have to stay in a hotel and live alone. And what do? Immediately either put the television on or immediately put the radio on or something. Some kind of communication must go on. Or I leave my room and go out. Somebody described mentally healthy people as self-contained apartments. You know, everything is there. If visitors are there, it's nice. But if visitors are not there, then also it's nice. So ability to live with themselves is a very important characteristic of mentally healthy people. As a result, for the same reason, they're fairly independent of the good opinion of others. They like good opinions, but if it doesn't come forth, it is not a matter of life and death for them. It's not necessary that Biswas must appreciate my lecture. If I were mentally healthy, which I'm not sure where I am, I'm certainly have an effort in that direction, but it is not necessary that people should appreciate. They have an ability to concentrate intensely on this focus which they have chosen. Some of them may look absent-minded, forgetful, lost, so on. But if they have chosen a particular mission to follow, their ability to concentrate on that issue is very high. They have a continued sense of appreciation. Now, what does it mean? It's a very beautiful statement. And an example he gives is that a man at 60 years of age is able to appreciate the beauty of his wife whom he married at the age of 20 in the same way he appreciated when he was 20. Simple little things. You wake up in the morning, you look outside the window, hi, what a beautiful day. You see a smile of the child, how lovely the child looks. Things appear, every little ordinary thing appears to have a sense of miracle. Why? Why is it that so? These are the people who don't get bored. That's the point. Normally, people get bored with things. If a stimulus is given again and again, we get attuned to it, adjusted to it, lose the freshness of it. But mentally healthy people are able to maintain a sense of freshness and appreciation. Finally, he said, and something very important, mentally healthy people are able to have mystical experiences. Now, what does it mean? Mystical experiences. All of us are familiar with mystical experience, let me tell you. It's not, one doesn't have to be a saint to have a mystical experience. When you listen to a piece of good music, or as I said, you see some beautiful scenery, you tend to go through a mystical experience. And what does that mean? Very simply and very, very ordinary language, losing a sense of self. That is, when I'm watching something very beautiful, I get lost in that and lose the sense of self, my separateness from it. Mystical experience is the losing the sense of self. So that what you are and what you are witnessing becomes one. If you permit me to be crude, I will say one example is the sexual experience of a mystical variety. A good sexual experience is one where you lose the sense of self. And mentally healthy people are able to have a mystical experience at number of times which is counted to be much more than ordinary people. They have ability to lose the sense of self. And not just that, in course of time, they are all able to recall or produce a mystical experience as if at will. That's the important point. So I have mentioned to you some of the characteristics of mentally healthy people according to Maslow. I would say all of us do not have all these qualities, but all of us must be having one or two of these qualities, and it is possible to cultivate the rest. I move on to description of the kind of person which from the Buddhist tradition is considered to be a Jivanmukta, to be a person who has achieved a particular higher stage of existence. And when I describe it, you will notice how similar that description is to what Maslow discovered experimentally. This description I have picked up from a commentary on Buddhist texts by a particular author called Huston Smith. And he says that in our lives, we have a number of layers of unconscious. Okay? After all, what we are seeing is conscious, but what we are seeing is determined by our unconscious self also. Just like what was said earlier, that there are biases introduced by what is inside. So our unconscious biases our perceptions, and he puts it very beautifully, these layers of unconscious are like convex lenses which distort the perception as they come. There is the convex lens of desire, interest, concerns, fears, needs, and so on. There are a number of lenses in our mind which distort the perception as it comes. But he said the deepest part of our unconscious is really a clear glass. The deepest part of our unconscious is a clear glass through which you can see the objective world as it is. And this he calls the sacred unconscious. There is a sacred level of unconscious within us which we can reach, if we can reach, if people who are able to reach that, they are able to see the world that is as it is. Not too different from the kind of description which Maslow found in his experimental work. According to Buddhist theory, there is no self inside. A self is really a bundle of our desires and aversions. That's all. And if we can look through, look beyond this bundle of desires and aversions, we are part of this objective world ourselves, what we are looking at. Huston Smith goes on to describe the characteristics of these people. He says, being a Jivanmukta is not a question of being excited or hyped. It's not that the person is always jumping about with joy and cheerfulness. It's not a question of having a greater adrenaline flow in your system. But all things to such a person are a big miracle. He doesn't live a drab life. He doesn't lead a taken for granted life. He doesn't lead a bored life. And again, I'm repeating this to show the similarity of what modern psychological research has shown in relation to something which was said years ago. Is a Jivanmukta always happy? Yes or no? He is comfortable in all situations. Again, a term which I've utilized earlier. He's comfortable in all situations, but demonstrate emotions which are appropriate to that situation. There's a story of a Zen master who was passing by the house, by a cottage, and he heard people crying. He went inside and found a child had died. So the family was crying, and this fellow also started crying along with. So one fellow said, "You are a Zen master. We thought you would be beyond all this." And then he answered, "It is doing this which puts me beyond all this." That is to say, doing the right thing which puts me beyond that. So while he was displaying a very, very painful emotion. At the same time, there was a sense of comfort pervading also, that the world is as it is and it's all right. It's okay. That kind of response, it's all right. You can cry, you can shout with joy, but inside a constant feeling, it's okay. You know, even to keep a little distance even from your own emotions. If you have been bad to me and you come next time, normally I'm always already ready to pounce on you. But something which has happened and gone need not always be kept inside as a motivation for our future actions. I move on to another little description of Sthita Prajna from Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita, those who have read, describes the ideal person, Sthita Prajna, and it's difficult to exactly translate it in English. I would very simply and perhaps crudely define it as a man with a stable temperament. A person who has a stable temperament. And this is a kind of a summary of a Sthita Prajna which I will read out to you. This man, this discriminate knower of reality, I want you to underline this, discriminate knower of reality. He knows reality as it is. He doesn't allow his needs and compulsions to distort his perception. Same thing. This discriminate knower of reality will never desist from action because it is impossible to stop action. Very simple. That's the first statement they make. That since it is impossible to stop action, he doesn't even think of doing that. In Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned that even if we don't do anything, at least we breathe. And that is action. So you can't stop action. However, this man will perform his actions skillfully. That's the next part. I think it's a very important point that ability to do whatever you're doing as best as you can is a very important part of mental health. Skillful action. To allow this skill to manifest itself, this man will act without anticipation. Without anticipation. Anticipation of pleasure if the results are favorable, or anticipation of unpleasantness if the results are unfavorable. Because, as we know, anticipation always distorts action. Now, it's a very well-known psychological piece of knowledge that if we are doing something, let us say if somebody is trying to shoot the gun and there is a target and we are shooting it, if in our mind we start wondering whether we are going to shoot right or wrong, our shot will always go wrong. We shoot without any kind of a predetermined action. We shoot. So your skill comes by working without anticipation. Next point. The guide for his action is the universal anukampa. That's the word, and I won't even translate it. The word used is anukampa, which means to vibrate with. I won't translate it as compassion. It's ordinarily translated as compassion, but compassion has some kind of a mushy kind of aspect to it, which you don't want to say. It's a very, very technical word. Anukampa, to vibrate with. That is to say, if you see a musical instrument, you strike one chord and the other chords vibrate along with. That is what is meant by anukampa. So if somebody is vibrating, you vibrate along with. Resonance is a better word. Now, Gita says that anukampa is the very law of conscious being. You cannot have any consciousness of anything unless you are in tune with it. Unless you are in tune with it, you can't be conscious of things. If I want to be conscious of the lady sitting here, Aruna, I have to be in tune with it. Otherwise, the consciousness I have of Aruna will be a distorted consciousness. It won't be the real Aruna. It will be my own imagery of Aruna. If I want to know Aruna as she is, I must be in tune with her. So, it's a very important point that a Sthita Prajna, a man of stable temperament, is able to be in tune with those around. And then, there's a very, very beautiful jump, I would say a poetic jump in this description. And then Gita says, through this Anukampa, this man will follow his own Swadharma. That is, he will certainly follow his own ethical code. But his code of conduct is such that since he is vibration with everything around in the universe, his actions will always be in harmony with the universal will. I want to underline this, that if you are a group of 5 or 6 people, you do your own thing. But if you are really in tune with the feelings of people who are with you, you will probably end up doing what you think is right for the whole group. Because you're in tune with them. So you are vibrating at your own pitch. You're doing your own Swadharma, your own way of doing things. But since you are by nature a kind of a person who's in tune with others around, you end up doing things which are comfortable to all the people also. And in the poetic gesture he makes is that if you are really in Anukampa, if you're really in tune with everything in the universe, your will is the universal will. Then you are God. Now, we are not all gods, nor we are wanting to be, but at least within a few people we live with, we can learn to live with a little bit in tune so that what we do is really comfortable, not only to us, but to others around. I'm coming back, I'm playing back the same tune which I started with, be comfortable and make others comfortable. Now I'll summarize here some of the points which appear to be so from the religious philosophies is the sense of comfort. Sense of comfort for yourself and sense of comfort for others. Second thing which becomes important to me is when being tuned with others. And third thing which really is most important is making the effort. Making the effort. There are few people in this world who are very lucky that the way they are born, they are probably mentally healthy. There people exist also who are right from birth mentally healthy. But most of us have to exert over it. And this exertion is worthwhile. I say that this exertion is worthwhile, but we know how few people really want to make this exertion. We have heard of many people who cry the cry of anguish which I played earlier, but having cried do not want to do anything about it. Because it is a difficult task. Pursuing the path of mental health is not easy. Krishna again in Bhagavad Gita says that out of 1,000 people who are there, one wants to come to me, and out of 1,000 who want to come to me, one will probably come. That is not an easy path. Path of self-transition, path of self-actualization, path of becoming healthy is a difficult path. So many people just don't want to go in. And if you are thinking of the kind of level of needs which Maslow said, some people are quite satisfied if their physical needs are met with. Some people are quite satisfied if their need of companionship are met with. Some people are quite satisfied if they are very important people in this world. But some people are not satisfied with all this, and path of mental health is for those who are not satisfied with these 3 layers and want to go further. And the cry of anguish also comes from those people. So it is not an easy path, but yet it is also a very easy path. Again, there's a Zen story which says that a man was walking about in the dark on a hill and he fell down. He fell down and he fell down the hill and he was trying to clutch at the various shrubs, grasses and so on, but he was slipping and slipping and slipping in the dark, and ultimately held on to something. And this was the dark of the night. He held on and held on and held on and held on till the daybreak. And when the day broke, he found that he was only a few inches away from the path. He could have let go and he would have reached there. That's the story how it is told, that if he had let go of that, he would have reached the right path. But very often, most of us are just unwilling to let go of all the things we are holding on to. And it's by letting go from what we are holding on to, we enter the path of mental health. But very often we don't even understand what this means. I've tried my best today. It's a difficult thing which I have tried to do. Describe to you what kind of life it is. Most people don't want to go there. There's again a Sufi story which is of great interest. It's a story, it said that somebody went to the squirrel and said, do you want to be a human being? And squirrel said, no, I don't want to be a human being. Who will collect my nuts if I become a human being? How will I find my nuts? And then went to the rat and said, do you want to be a human being? The human being has such weak teeth, they can't gnaw at all. I don't think I want to be a human being. Then went to a donkey and said, do you want to be a human being? Said, no. Human beings can't run as fast as I can. Why do I want to be a human being? So many people are quite happy with the achievements we have had and do not want to be something more, something higher. So unless that desire is there, much of what I've been talking today is not of much significance either. But the point is that this desire can be cultivated. If we want to do away with the anguish of life, if we want to do away with the kind of self-doubt which Hamlet experienced, or the pain which Ram expressed in that passage, or the difficulties which you and I go through, difficulties which age us much quicker than we should be aging, I suppose it is something worthwhile, something which can be tried. I leave it at that. Thank you. Mentioning that while psychiatry has done a fair amount of good in the treatment of the mentally ill, it hasn't been able to do much in the field of mental health as such. Now, some of the Eastern traditions, some of the Eastern mystical traditions, claim to do just that, claim to raise the level of mental health. And yoga is one such tradition. A few years ago, I decided to explore these claims, whether these claims are true. When I looked at the scientific literature in this field, I found out that some degree of work had been done in the field of neurophysiology, in the field of cardiovascular physiology, to see the impact of yoga on respiration, on heart rate, on the brain waves and so on. While it is of some interest to us as psychologists and as human beings, whether a yogi can stop his heartbeat or he can't, much more interesting is to see whether yoga can help in raising the state of mental health. Unfortunately, psychologists have done very little work in this area. There seem to be two reasons for this. At one time, psychology was defined as the science of behavior and experience. In our trying to mimic the natural sciences, what we end up doing is psychology has just become the study of behavior only, and experience has been sort of derecognized. We are told that it is so because it is difficult to study experience, it's difficult to study the subjective mental states, but instead of developing strategies to simplify these difficulties, to make these difficulties easier, what has psychology has done is to eschew the whole field altogether. You find hardly any reference to the experiential aspect of mind in the textbooks of psychology these days. The other reason is that scientists would not like to be personally involved in such studies. And it is my belief, and it seems to be self-evident, that any examination of this kind, that is examination of traditions like yoga and the experiential side of it, has to start with one's own experience through it. I think a scientist needs to go through the experience, first of all, to examine his own subjective states, what happens to one's mind. And in course of time, if number of psychologists who have had some training in the discipline of psychology go through these kind of experiences, cull out their basic tenets, compare the results, one can start making some sense of it at that time. That number of details brought out by people who have gone through this themselves, we can say, look, these are the items which are common between the experiences of so many people, and probably these are now facts. This is not to say that there is a dearth of experiential reports of yoga. It isn't so. Many people have written about their experience, but they are not from the field of psychological sciences. I would say, with some degree of humility, but I would still say that there is a certain training and discipline which the psychologists, because of their own subject, have in the field. And while many of the subjective reports from non-psychologists are very effusive, very poetic, very sweet, very interesting, that's so much more in a adjectival language than in a phenomenological language. And that was one reason, that was another reason why I thought I would like to go through the experience of yoga and see what happens to my mental states. So what I did was I took a guru, I apprenticed myself to a guru, and for 1 year I studied with him, spending almost 3 to 4 hours a day in the practices of yoga as directed by him. And in the evening, for a couple of hours, I would sit down and write down my experience. What has happened to me? He also asked me to keep a dream diary. Now, dreams are important in the study of psychology. And for this 1 year, I kept a dream diary also to see what kind of changes occur in my dreams, not only in my conscious experiences. And it is the result of this 1 year study I would like to share with you today. But before I do that, I think it would be of some interest to look at the theoretical aspects. Yoga, there are different kinds of yoga. You all know, you have the kind of yoga you are practicing this morning is an example of Hatha yoga. You do various asanas. There is a style of yoga called Kundalini yoga, which is supposed to be based on a theory of a rising sense of power from the lower end of the spine going up. There is the philosophy of Karma Yoga, which you see in Bhagavad Gita. There is the Jnana Yoga, that is yoga through knowledge, and so on. But about 2000 years ago, while these yoga traditions are very old, some people think it's pre-Aryan, about 2000 years ago, Patanjali a sage of India. He collected together what he thought was common between all different branches of yoga, and they made a treatise, made a treatise, which he called the Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga, I think, is a kind of a summation of what Patanjali thought was the best out of all different kinds of yoga. This Raja Yoga is philosophically connected with the Sankhya philosophy, based on the Sankhya philosophy, but it is flexible enough to be inserted into various other traditions. Yoga is a part of Buddhist practices. Yoga is a part, as I said, mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. Yoga is a part of Tantra, and so on. So yoga is a set of practices, set of psychophysiological practices, which can be inserted into various spiritual, religious disciplines, and so on. So what I'll do today, I'll start with a very brief description of Sankhya philosophy and pick out some major points from the Raja Yoga of Patanjali, and then go on to describing my own experience. Now, what actually happened was quite different. My guru did not allow me to read any of these things till I had gone through the experiences, because he thought, by reading I'll be biased and I might start reporting what I've read. So in fact the reading occurred much later, but it might be easier for my description today to start with the reading and then go on to the experiential details. Those who are well versed in Indian philosophy, I owe them an apology, because I am very deliberately trying to compress and simplify something which can take many, many lectures into one quarter of a lecture. But let me try. According to Sankhya, the reality consists of two different entities, the Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha, in a crude language, you may consider equivalent to consciousness. And Prakriti is the material world around. According to Sankhya, Purusha is timeless, unchanging, qualityless awareness. Now, it's very easy for me to utter these words, but as I utter them, I am not quite sure what this means. Because you and I are not in a state of mind where we can even understand what being qualityless means. Because everything we know has some quality. The moment we describe it, we describe it in terms of qualities. But anyway, Purusha is the unchanging qualityless awareness, and all that is changing is Prakriti. Everything we see changing around is Prakriti. The example given is of a light which is focused in a room. When you put the lamp off, you see nothing. But when you put the lamp off on, you start seeing things. So Purusha is that light which is essential to the exposition of Prakriti. That is, whatever is happening in Prakriti is not exposed unless this light is on. For our purposes, the most important point is that Chitta, that is the mind, is a part of Prakriti and not of Purusha. Yes, sure. Sorry. I said, from our point of view, what is most important is that mind is a part of Prakriti and not of Purusha, because mind is ever-changing. Consciousness is different from mind. Once again, you are familiar with these terms. Prakriti is composed of three different sub-entities or gunas, the sattva, the rajas and the tamas, which are present in various combinations, in different beings, in different forms of life, in different form of non-living matter also. While sattva or a stage of enlightenment may be our goal, it is important to remember that rajas and tamas are as important for prakriti as the rajas, as the sattva is. Because any movement, any activity towards going towards sattva is also conducted by rajas, unless you have rajas in your temperament, let's say, you're unlikely to move towards sattva also. And tamas is necessary. They say that things which are, unless there is a destruction, no new construction takes place. So even tamas is necessary. One can have questions on this, but today is not the day for having those questions. In our ordinary existence, as we are, the Purusha is so tainted with prakriti, I will explain that later, that chitta, that is the mind, does not realize the difference between the two. That is, the way we are, the way our brains work, the way our minds work, there is a kind of a mess up, where this mind is not able to distinguish that consciousness is different from material world or material body or so on. And this not understanding the difference between the Purusha and the Prakriti leads to miseries. The beginning of misery in our existence is because of not realizing that consciousness is separate from material existence and consciousness has no quality. So this is the beginning of ignorance, avidya. And this kind of ignorance then leads to other kinds of miseries. Because of this ignorance, we become egotistical. We start believing in having those properties which we do not have. We start having attractions and repulsions, raga and dvesha. And we start having a fear of death. While Purusha cannot die, while consciousness really cannot die, it is because of this mix-up, one starts believing that Purusha can finish off also. So our fear of death starts from that. If this difference is, if this ignorance was not there, then one would not be scared of death, because consciousness is going to continue anyway. But these kleshas or miseries are the result of this ignorance. Now, what do you do when you are miserable? When one is miserable, one wants to do something about it. So, the confusion between the separation of Purusha and Prakriti leads to miseries, and miseries leads to action. The karma, the action, is the result of miseries motivate you to doing something. Now, when action occurs, all actions will leave some residues. Whatever we do, leave some results. These results, the impression, the residue of our actions are our samskaras. That is, right from childhood, let's say, we are doing things and the result of that is being left in our mind complex in form of samskaras. And these impressions then rise up as vasanas or personality tendencies. It's interesting from the point of view of a psychologist that our personality is determined by our actions. Now, this is, I think, reasonably understandable, but where we might separate our paths from understanding Sankhya would be when they say that the actions you committed in your last life are also have left some residues which will then determine your personality in the next journey. Now, unless you are appreciative of the whole concept of reincarnation, this might not appeal to you. But by some stretch of imagination, one could use the modern biological language also. What maybe they are talking about is that some of the personality factors are in our genes. That is, which have been brought not by our actions, but by our previous history. Now, I won't stretch the analogy too far. What Sankhya is saying is something quite different. But it is of interest to me as a psychologist that our personality is the resultant of our actions. Is a very, very a courageous kind of statement. Okay, I missed that out. Each new action we do interacts with our previous collation of personality, modifying the personality as it goes along, which modifies our future actions. What we do changes our personality, changes and then personality will change our future actions. Now I go on to the description of some of the major sutras of Patanjali's Rajyoga. It is said that while the actions you have conducted before will always have the results, it is possible by going through yoga to reach a stage when your future actions are not going to leave any residues. That is, your future actions are going to be clean, precise actions. And yoga is then a technique employed to see that our future actions do not leave any residues. Ultimately, after having finished off the results of all our previous action, we can enter the stage of moksha or no more reincarnation. That is the philosophical impact. I don't understand it. I have only described it. I don't understand what really moksha means. The most oft quoted sutra in Raj Yoga is that yoga is chitta vritti nirodha. That yoga is the inhibition of fluctuations of mind. We all know that our mind is constantly fluctuating. I don't have to describe that to you. You have experienced it. Our moods keep on changing. Thoughts come and go. Ups and downs occur. And the whole purpose of yoga, according to Patanjali, is to stop the fluctuation of mind. Stop the changes which go on occurring in our mental states. Let me go on to a little further description. The next important sutras, according to me, are those which say that the most important conditions for achieving this aim, that achieving the aim of stopping the fluctuation of mind, are two. Two important conditions. One is abhyasa or effort, practice, repetition. And the other is vairagya, that is, slowly giving up the desires. Slowly not letting desires affect our actions. Patanjali says that the path of yoga is not easy. In fact, there are many obstacles in the way. The obstacles, or vikshepas as they are called, these he labels as disease, dullness, carelessness, laziness, greed, tendency to misjudge and misinterpret, mental instability and distractibility. If you suffer from these problems, you'll find doing yoga very difficult. But he says the first step in yoga is to carry out such practices which will remove these vikshepas, which will remove these obstacles. So before you go on to the yoga proper, Patanjali suggests to you spending some time, if not your whole life, spending time in removing these obstacles. And I like what is described there, and I want to share it with you. How do you do it? How do you remove these obstacles? He says it is possible to remove these obstacles but through following means. First of all, actively cultivating the attitudes of friendliness, compassion, gladness and equanimity. Actively. Yesterday somebody was asking me, we know what the characteristics of mentally healthy people are, but how do we achieve that? And Patanjali says, actively try to develop the attitude of friendliness, compassion, happiness and equanimity. These are not something which is not possible to do. If we will love ourselves enough, it is possible to do this a little by little. Second, he says, when you get tensed up and anxious, take long breaths. Long breaths itself is a way of cutting down these obstacles. Concentrate on happier experiences of your past. When your mind starts thinking, direct your mind to those past experiences which are happier experiences. Instead of concentrating on the unhappy experience of life, make yourself remember the happier experiences. Then he says, think of those amongst your friends and acquaintances, those people who are themselves steady of mind. One thing is, he tells you to remember your own mental state when you were in a more stable phase. Then he says, try to think of people you know who are of steady mind. And then he says, you can reduce the akshepas by self-study, by examining yourself, by examining your mind, by examining your sleep, by examining your dreams. This is very explicitly stated. 2000 years before Freud, it was said that examination of your sleep and dreams helps you to improve and change yourself. Then he says, once these akshepas are attended to, one starts modestly on the path of yoga by performing Kriya Yoga, a preliminary set of practices. These include certain austerities, a contemplation of what's going on in one's mind, development of an attitude of surrender to a higher being. Now, it's important, this higher being, according to yoga, has a very specific connotation. Yoga does not explicitly talk of God anywhere. Sankhya, of course, keeps away from it totally. But yoga does talk of higher being. But when you try to study the sutras well, it appears to me at least that he is talking about an ideal state rather than by something which can be equated to what we now understand as God. God is really not talked about in Sankhya and yoga. Okay, once a certain degree of comfort is acquired in the path of Kriya Yoga, one launches into what may be called the yoga proper or Ashtanga. Now, that I'm sure you have all heard of. What is Ashtanga? It's the eightfold path, eight limbs, Ashtanga, eight limbs to yoga proper. These are the yamas, niyamas, asanas, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Some of you must have memorized this also. This is well known. But let's have a little look at that. Yamas and niyamas are ethical do's and don'ts. Things which in your day-to-day life you should be doing and should not be doing. Let me recite them to you, but let me say a little more about. Yamas are the vows of self-restraint, the don'ts. These include abstentions from violence, falsehood, excessive sexuality, and acquisitiveness. And the niyamas are the vows of observances. These include purity, contentment, austerity, self-study, and self-surrender to a higher will. These are the first two limbs. The third limb is asana. Before I go further, let me say, as far as I understand of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, he doesn't see this as hierarchy. It isn't that you have to do yama first and then niyama and then asana and so on. Depending upon your own temperament, personality, you can enter the path of yoga through one means and others will come easier to you. Some people feel it more comfortable to go the path of meditation, some people more comfortable through asana, some people through pranayama. So depending upon your temperament, you might find it easy. But there are people who disagree with what I say. Asana. You are all doing asanas these days in the morning. But it's very interesting what Patanjali has to say about asanas. He says, asana means sit in a steady and comfortable posture with relaxation of effort and concentrate on the concept of endlessness. Now, while you are doing a lot of monkey tricks every morning with your body, all Patanjali asks you to do is to sit comfortably in one place in a relaxed manner, and while you are sitting at that point, do not think of getting up. I think that's what he means. Because if you are also thinking of after getting up, I have to do this and that, then you are not in the right asana. Asana is that posture of yours where your thought processes are limited to that posture alone and don't go further. I think it's very important to remember that. Pranayama. Once again, there are yogic traditions which have developed very, very complex system of pranayama, but according to Patanjali, it's very simple. Pranayama is the practice of temporary cessation of breath in inspiration, in expiration, and in between inspiration and expiration. That is, practice stopping your breath while you're taking it in, or while you're taking it out, or in between taking it in and out. All he's asking you is to learn to stop your breath for a while. And I can put it to you that if you start just this practice of stopping your breath for a while, one of the things you will note is you will become more conscious of your bodily processes. It depends on how long you can do it at a time, but the idea, we use this principle nowadays in modern psychology through feedback. I'll talk to a bit about later, but your bodily state affects your mental state and your mental state affects your bodily state. So if you learn to slow down your breathing or even learn to stop your breathing processes, you are ultimately going to get calmer. The next is pratyahara. It's an extremely difficult concept to understand. I'm not sure whether I have understood it well at all, but translated it means withdrawal of senses from objects. As far as I understand, I tend to interpret it as do not use your thoughts and memories to distort the images as they come through. That is to separate your mind from what you're seeing. The three last, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, can be taken altogether. Very crudely they are compared to meditation. Now, what is dharana? We all know that if we are concentrating on anything, be it an object, be it a thought, be it a mood state, whatever, normally it is impossible to keep your concentration at a single point for more than 3 seconds. Physiologically, this is proved. After 3 seconds, your mind shifts you can't concentrate, and you have to bring it back. Again, it goes away, you have to bring it back. So, dharana is actually starting an act of concentration. And Patanjali is quite free in the choice of the object you can concentrate on. You can take a deity in your mind, if that is important to you. You can take a glass of water in front of you, you keep it that and concentrate on that. Or you concentrate on a concept you have, an idea you have. But whatever, whether it is in your senses or whether it is in a conceptual frame, you learn to concentrate a little longer than 3 seconds. Because that is what is possible for you. When you are able to concentrate long enough, dharana becomes dhyana. Dhyana is the ability to concentrate on a single focus for a long enough time. And when, during dhyana, the sense of I disappears, you have reached the stage of samadhi. Very simple. That is, when I am concentrating on the glass of water, I am watching it, and I am able to watch it for a long enough time, but I know that I am watching it. That feeling remains. The moment the feeling of I disappears, and only object remains, you have reached the stage of samadhi. So samadhi is not something which is difficult to achieve. If you practice it, it's not such a esoteric mystical thing. You should practice this process. It is possible to reach, at least for a short time, the stage of samadhi. It's possible to be in a samadhi for a few seconds. He of course goes on to talk further and says, in the deepest of samadhis, which is called the nirbija samadhi, even the object disappears. What you are concentrating on, even that disappears, and what remains is pure awareness. Now, I can read it out to you. I don't understand what it means because I have not reached that stage. Then he says, if a person keeps on practicing samadhi for a long enough time, a moment will come, a time will come, that with regular practices of yoga, you might acquire special miraculous powers or siddhis. And it's interesting that in the sutras, about 1/5 of the sutras out of the total 290 are occupied by description of the various siddhis. I find it odd. A person who is otherwise talking, I would say, very scientifically and very clearly, spends so much time in describing siddhis, and some very odd ones are there. You may gain knowledge of past and future, meaning of sounds produced by all beings, you can understand how animals talk, knowledge of what goes on in the mind of others, ability to be invisible, strength equal to that of elephant, and so on. All this is described in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. I am not sure whether these are insertions which have come on later, or whether he really meant that, but the fact is that these are past part of the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Knowing, understanding Patanjali is a person who is fairly clear in his concepts, if he has described it himself, I am sure he means it. And if he means it, I do not know of anybody, I do not know, who has acquired these siddhis. I have, in the process of my research, tried to go on and study many different yogis. I went to various parts of the countries, into Himalayas also. I really haven't come across anybody who has the siddhis, so that is still to me open to question. A yogi is not advised to remain attached to these special powers. If he is able to resist this attachment, he gradually becomes awareness of the separateness of Purusha and Prakriti. That original ignorance disappears. And once he acquires that state, this leads to a supremacy over all states and forms. That is, you become a supreme power. A non-attachment to this supremacy produces a sense of bliss or kaivalya. This bliss is transcendental, and in this state, there is cognition of all objects simultaneously. That is, everything which is happening in space and time is totally available to you, to your consciousness. and a non-attachment to even this bliss leads to dharma megha samadhi or liberation or moksha. That is the whole story of Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Now, some of it I can understand and I have told you what I appreciate. The rest of it I have just described because I neither have the experience of it nor have I met anybody whom I think has been able to achieve that. But leave that apart. I think it's time that I start talking about my own experience, how I went into it. You see, I had two objects in mind. One very simple one was an important one. I thought India has learned so much about science from the West. The science of psychology at least is one area where we can give something to the West also. So let me explore what is being done. Purely as a professional interest, I was interested in learning about yoga so that I could describe this to my other colleagues from other cultures. The second thing, I must admit, as I was saying yesterday, there were times in my life when I said, look, there must be some better way of living. I was involved in, I was a head of the Department of Psychiatry. There were number of situations which made you disturbed, tense, 600 patients, 40 residents, 50 office people, politics of the academic life, you're all aware of that. And I said, to hell with it, you know, there must be some other way of living. Let me see whether I can learn it. So there was definitely a personal interest. Also, I wouldn't deny that. So I went along looking for teachers. I met many gurus at that time. Some of them very famous gurus, some of them of jet set variety. Those who are in India one day, second day, then USA and so on. So I kept on circulating among them just to see if there's somebody I like, with whom I would like to work. I remember one particular guru who is very, very famous. And I think he was interested in making contact with me also. I was the head of the department of a very prestigious institution. And he sent words to me, look, come and talk to me, etc., etc. And then he said, you know, we are very scientific. We have EEG machines to judge state, what happens in meditation, etc. And I told him, but EEG is a very, very crude instrument. It cannot really tell what goes on your mind. And he said to me, but no, my EEG machine is made in Germany. So, why am I mentioning this is that the quality of gurus I met at that time were not all that. It wasn't a happy experience. It took me about a couple of years to really pin down on somebody I liked. And I think it is mentioned in our tradition that your liking your guru and guru liking you is a very essential thing. You must get along with each other. So ultimately I found a guru whom I could get along with and I started working with him. He took some time in taking me also. He took his own time in accepting me as his disciple, and I told him very clearly, look, what I want to do is a study. I'm a researcher. I'm interested in seeing what happens to my mind. So after some time, he said, okay, I'll take you as a student. He said, but you have to do a few things before I start teaching you the practices. He said, first of all, create some order around you. Order around you, not for its own sake, but to get things so well arranged that one could leave them anytime and walk away. I think it's a very beautiful statement that we must organize things in our life in such a way that if we have to leave them, we feel that we have done our complete job, that we don't not finish and just run away. Most of the time our life is in such a mess that when people die, a lot of mess is still left. He said, why do you have to wait for such an instant?